G'day folks, talk to Dr. Tracy Westerman, a proud Ngiyama woman from the far northwest, up in the Pilbara, Western Australia, and she runs the Gilia Institute, focused on Indigenous mental health, and committed on increasing the numbers of First Nations psychologists around Australia, addressing real issues here with the escalating rates of Indigenous mental health and child suicides, which we have the highest rates in the world. Incarceration, rehabilitation, cultural issues, racism, and also where Dr. Westerman and the team are focusing on programs, treatments of best practice, evidence-based intervention, research, and psychology scholarships for First Nations people. Solid work. And if you like the podcast, hit that subscribe button. Be much appreciated. And we've also got a Patreon page. So if you want to help further the podcast, the channel, click on the link within the description. And if you contribute and want to roll with the squad, that'd be awesome. And want to thank our sponsors, Permabil Australia, the greatest electric wheelchairs in the land. Wouldn't be sitting in anything else but these four wheels right here. And they've got great assistive tech also. So righto, let's get into it.
Keep rolling with Jake Briggs. Oh,
yeah. Dr. Tracy Westerman, thanks for jumping on the podcast and having a yarn with us. I really appreciate your time because I know you're very busy. So,
no worries. Thank you so much for having me.
Awesome. So I just want to jump into first just, where's your mob from and where are you located at?
I love starting a story like, I love starting interviews like this because a lot of people, I'm from a very remote part of Western Australia, and so often what I'm doing is I'm giving people a geography lesson as well as introducing myself, which is actually really cool. And Aboriginal way, that's kind of how we introduce ourselves anyway, don't we, in relation to land, country and mob. So I grew up in a remote part of Western Australia. That's a little place called Yandeyarra Station, which I have to kind of put people geographically where that is. Very remote between Port Hedland and Marble Bar in the very remote parts of Western Australia, the Pilbara. So my mob, I'm of a Ngiyama mob, so yeah.
Yeah, way up north.
Mm. Two temperatures, Jake, hot and bloody hot. I
Yeah, I agree with you there. And so where are you at now? You're still in WA, but like right down south in the Perth area, yeah?
Yeah. So I'm actually coming from Wadjuk Noongar country today in Perth. So have been privileged to spend a fair bit of time in beautiful Noongar country in Perth.
Awesome. So it's really important work, you know, that you're doing in regards to, you know, straight up psychology because, you know, there's a lot of practitioners out there and when it's got to do with general physical health, but, you know, that's where, you know, where people look after the body, but the mind's really important, what you can harness there and, you know, and where you can improve and help, you know, it's, you know, helping oneself or if it's like yourself helping a lot of mob out there and people in general. So, and just along to do with anything to do with mental health and especially when it's got to do with First Nations people and, you know, with Noongar people over there in WA. So,
it's a privilege and honour.
Can you talk us through, so you're currently the Managing Director for Indigenous Psychology Services, yeah?
Yeah, that's right, yep. Yeah. And I've just also launched a charity about 12 months ago called the Western and Gilia Institute for Indigenous Mental Health, and that's been really awesome, Jake, because the idea is to get more Indigenous psychologists out into our highest-risk communities, which are our First Nations communities, and also our most remote communities. And so that's just been a real joy, frankly, to be able to do something that you can see every single day is making a difference to, you know, mob that, frankly, you know, there's only about 6% of Aboriginal people in mental health crisis that access services. And so much of that, obviously, is about going into a service that doesn't really understand your worldview. And so that's why I got into psychology myself, obviously, was that you were just seeing so much need and there was this disconnect that people would kind of go into a service and people wouldn't understand them and wouldn't understand the worldview. And so often what would happen is people would often not go in at all, or they go in and last one session, and that's what you don't want. So yeah, so it's been incredible. But the business I run, Indigenous Psychological Services, yeah, for 23 years, and
nice,
done that in the complete absence of government funding. So I'm quite proud of that fact, actually.
Really?
Yeah, not one cent of government funding ever. Yeah,
solid.
Yeah.
Good work.
Yeah.
Seriously. You know, because that's where it, not just, you know, where a lot, you know, if it's psychologists or mob in general, when it's a lot of focus on, you know, when it's got to do with grants and other situations like that, you know what I mean? So, and government funding. So, no, that's impressive. So, and has that always been the driver for, in regards to what got you involved into psychology? It's just seeing the need for our people and some of the, you know, of where they're falling through the gaps in some of the scenarios?
Yeah, definitely. And the thing is, I always say that, you know, it's the hardest thing to go in and put your hand up to say that you're struggling. That's the first thing. And I always say that every single client is actually involuntary. No one wants to go in to have to see a psychologist, and that taking that first step is really difficult. And so when you've got all these cultural barriers on top of that, it makes the challenge even greater. And so what we shouldn't be in a position of is having people coming in and making that first step and then feeling as if that's been a waste of their time. You know, I grew up in the remote areas of the Pilbara, and, of course, you still have a lot of trauma through forcible removal. The origin is forcible removal, always is. You know, you remove children from families, and those families never recover, those children never recover. And sadly, in our country, that's never been fully acknowledged and it's never been fully healed.
Yep.
And so when I decided to become a psychologist, I thought, okay, cool, I want to go down to university, I want to go down to Perth, and I'm going to learn all this amazing stuff that I'm going to then take back to my community and make a difference. And I sat in a lecture theatre, and the first thing was, Jake, I came from a community of, you know, a couple of hundred. I did school there.
Yep.
And in the lecture theatre, there was like 1,000 people in this lecture theatre, and that's and that was overwhelming, you know, buses and crossing the road, and it was just terrifying because I was just such a such a country bumpkin. And then I said,
so did you spend, so up until like the age of say 17, 18, going into uni, you spent that whole time up north and then flew down south, yeah?
Yeah, and I did school of the air, even worse, Jake. I did school of the air or distance education. And so I was literally learning on the radio. So I'd get rung up and send stuff. And so I had a school, like a small school, but I had to essentially do most of my subjects through distance education to get into university. So I'd never caught a bus, I'd never caught an escalator, I'd never caught a lift. so everything was just terrifying. I remember a friend of mine, you know, saying that I literally would grab someone's hand to cross the road because I'd never seen that much traffic. I'd never seen a traffic light. And so, yeah, so there was all that. And then I went into lecture theatres, and I was expecting the training to match the statistics of what we were dealing with, the highest rates of suicide in the world, highest rates of incarceration in the world. And I got into about third year, and the word Aboriginal was not mentioned once.
Well, see, that's something I wanted to touch on. So just what your experience was like going through uni and when it's got to do the whole Aboriginality, because you see what, you know, you learn or what you don't learn through primary school and public school systems when it's got to do with Aboriginality and really what should be interjected there from what I think, and be the same with yourself. But and then when it steps up to uni, so, you know, where's the Aboriginality and some of the statistics start running in?
Yeah, absolutely. And so there's that thing where you are not just able to sit back and learn. You have to constantly advocate. You have to constantly be a critical thinker. And it's really interesting that I used to watch other, you know, non-Indigenous psychology students, and they would literally go into the lecture theatre, take the notes back and learn those notes off by heart, and then come out and blitz the exam. And so that was, that's what white privilege actually looks like. It actually looks like the fact that you have, you can do a lot more with a lot less. But as an Aboriginal person, you had to constantly question everything that was being taught and then try and translate it for mob. And so you couldn't rely on the science. And psychology is very much about the scientist-practitioner model, which means your science informs your practice. And so when you've got a reality that, you know, psychology is being tested on a mainstream population, so much stuff that they teach you inadvertently is having the opposite effect. It's actually making things worse inadvertently, yeah.
And so what was the experience, say, when you're going through university, right, and there, and you got some of the professors and whoever it may be that are putting across some of this information, was like, would you be in the position where you'd be talking back to the professor or whatever it may be, or you'd just sort of be sitting there shaking your head, or what was that feeling like?
Look, I guess it was really challenging, to be honest. It's a good question, because when you're an 18, 19-year-old kid, you have no power. And so often what would happen is you start to question whether you've made the right decision. And so that's the big issue, and that's why I started the scholarship, to get more Indigenous psychologists into the profession, because what will happen is you'll put your hand up and say, hang on a sec, this is not relevant for my mob, and then it'll get essentially basically get dismissed and the evidence isn't there or whatever. And so after 3 years, I questioned whether I'd made the right decision, and I thought if I ever see another university again, it'd be too soon. And I really questioned, I thought, this is psychology and I've got it wrong. And fortunately, I went out and worked in the Western Desert. And it's really funny. I look at that now and I was 22 or something.
Where's that out, like Kalgoorlie way and all that sort of area? Yeah.
Warburton, Warrakoon, Chikali, Blackstone. And to put it in perspective, Warburton is where the petrol and glue sniffing first started, where it became, you know, global attention was put on those communities. And it was not unusual. You're going into a reality in which you've got 30% of the community walk around with tins of petrol and paint around their neck. Just literally solvent abuse was just so rife in those areas. And that was really challenging. As I look back now and I go, what was I thinking? But that was the best thing I could have done, because remote communities, there's nowhere to hide. There's your learning curve. I'll honestly say that even now I reflect back, that was the steepest learning curve I've ever had in my entire life, you know, by a country mile, because every day you were dealing with stuff that was so clinically and culturally complex that you had to respond to it. You had to deal with whatever you could. And so that experience gave me the confidence that I could actually do it, you know, that I could actually make a difference. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, especially being, like you said, there's nowhere to hide.
No.
So especially being exposed to some of those confronting images, and especially if you're seeing some, you know, real young kids getting amongst like solvents and whatever it may be to, you know, to get high in some sort of way. But, and just you saying that as an Aboriginal person and just trying to make, you know, trying to reconcile with what's going on in the landscape, but, you know, what you can do to make that better. And so after taking that in, so with the time that was spent out there and just taking in that community, so what was your thoughts and next steps of it? Like, okay, like there's science that I've learnt through uni that isn't always applicable to who we are. So what am I going to try and bring to the forefront of the science to what's a reality of our people and what's going to make it better for the communities?
Yeah, and I think that's the thing, that the science is really useful. I'm not suggesting throw it all out. But it's often good to give examples. Hey, so often I talk a lot about culture-bound syndromes or culture-bound phenomena, and a great example is you'd have someone who looks like they're floridly psychotic, so seeing and hearing things that no one else can see and hear, right? And if that happens to people, they're often diagnosed as schizophrenic or psychotic, because they're, you know, they have, you know, hallucinations, auditory hallucinations, they have, you know, visual hallucinations, they have all these things that put you into a diagnosis of a clinical disorder, which is schizophrenia or psychosis. However, you can also have people who are having spiritual visits of someone who's passed away, okay, which is very, very common for Aboriginal people. And so
100%.
So I've spent a lot of time, and particularly go to remote communities. Another example is people will sorry cut during times of grief. Now, how do you separate that from self-harm? And so the science is useful in terms of knowing what schizophrenia and psychosis looks like. The cultural bit that I've actually provided in terms of my work is figuring out at what point the diagnosis of psychosis schizophrenia is appropriate and at what point it's a cultural grief process. Or, you know, is it self-harm or is it sorry cutting? Is it longing for country? Is it depression? So there's all these different sorts of culture-bound syndromes that, again, if you just take a mainstream approach to this, you're going to get it wrong really quickly, Jay. And
And I loved how you put it right there, cultural-bound syndromes.
Yeah.
But that's really important, I think, for a lot of mob out there throughout the country to really take note of that word and really amplify that, I think.
Yeah. And it's really interesting. I was one of the first people to start talking about that. These sorts of things are known about globally with Indigenous cultures. Canadian, you know, Americans have it. You know, Maori populations have it. It's very common. But I've just published the first paper on this in terms of scientific paper. And so the value of that, Jake, is now scientists, psychologists, psychiatrists around Australia have to actually pay attention to this now, because prior to that they could dismiss it and say it's not a real thing. It's all in your heads, or it's, you know, something that you made up or whatever. And so what we want to be able to do is force mainstream to join us, you know, to understand our worldview, but in a way that's directed by us and really clear, you know.
See, that frustrates me. Hey, so like when you're saying, oh, it's like you made it up, whatever, like when it's people that are looking at whatever country they're from, and what I mean by country, like Aboriginal nations, and some are their spirits and gods that they look up to, and they're going to say, you know, what are you on about? But if someone's going to go in and talk about if it's one of the Abrahamic religions, they're not going to question that, are they?
Definitely.
Which is, and you know, when you're talking about some of those religions, but you're looking at some of the Aboriginal religions, you're talking 65,000, 120 thousands of years going back before a lot of these are the mainstream religions, you know, but then they get pushed aside, which is so frustrating to me.
Yeah, definitely. And it's a challenge for the average clinician because, like, their focus is to do no harm, right? So if you've got someone who's psychotic and they're potentially harmed to self or others, then, of course, where they land is they go, okay, let's treat this in the best possible mainstream way that we know, and that's often to medicate people with antipsychotics. The trouble is if you get assessment wrong, you get treatment wrong, you make things worse. And so what we found with a lot of First Nations people who are experiencing culture-bound phenomena, things don't get better. Right? So what happens is they get medicated, and the symptoms don't actually disappear. So that's not what we want. Often what happens then is if someone's experiencing something culture-bound, cultural treatment, things get better. Okay, so that's
yes,
so cultural issue, cultural treatment, things get better. But I always say all roads lead to assessment. Get assessment wrong, get treatment wrong, make things worse. And so that's what I spent a lot of time doing, is teaching people how to get that starting point right, and then everything leads from there. So just to make it simpler for people.
And who are some of your teachers, or, you know, if you're looking at some of the mentors, whether they were within community, like when you're out, you know, west in the desert, or if it was back in Perth or even up north where you're from, that helped you along this journey carving into psychology, or just you as an Aboriginal person?
Yeah, look, easily my elders and elders. I was so lucky through the western desert. I was in Kalgoorlie based there and travelling out to remote areas, and Wongai mob, and, you know, they all know who they are, and, you know, they essentially, when I was a 22, 23-year-old kid, let me stuff up, let me make mistakes, you know. And they were so generous. And that's the thing that I love about mob, you know, we are natural teachers of people. We love imparting knowledge, and we love you know, as long as you are respectful and learn your place, that's the big thing. Elders will growl you and they'll say, learn your place. And so you have to step back and be guided by. And like, I've lost count of the number, whether it's law people who have shown me things amazingly, you know, whether it's nunkery who have shown me things, just elders who will sit and yarn and spend their time and teach you about culture and all those things. I have just been so fortunate in the number of people who have taught me things. It hasn't been academics that I've learnt the most from, interestingly enough. It's been elders, it's been, you know, people at a community level. Community always know what's going on in their own communities. They always know. They just need the support from people like me to do the complex stuff, do the heavy lifting. And so that's when it works the best, is when you understand who's responsible for what, you know.
Yeah. And you're so right, when you got some of your elders, like, it doesn't matter who you are, what level of society you're in, you know, if you are a doctor or a sports person, whoever it may be, like, going back home to country, like, your elders and your family's going to, you know, pull you into place and, you know, where it's finding that grounding again and, you know, and that's what it's all about, and it's soaking in that, you know, getting the dirt between your toes and the country that you're at and getting in that atmosphere, and, you know, it's leveling that out and trying to, you know, and when you're going back to whatever the setting may be, it's, you know, taking your culture and your people with you and having that grounded base, you know.
And never forgetting where you're from, Jay. I mean, I remember once when I was flying around the whole Australia doing lots and lots of different things, and I got asked to do a keynote presentation in a little place called Roban, which a lot of my mob are from, and it's near Karratha. And I literally travelled for 2 days to do a 1 hour presentation in front of all my young mob, and, you know, and everyone's just going, what are you doing? You travel for 2 days to get back to. And then when I started talking and they introduced me, Dr. Tracy Westerman, as a keynote speaker from the Nyambal mob, and you should say on my elders, just the pride. And that's what I'm talking about. You know, you never, ever, ever forget where you're from. And you always go back to country, and you always, you know, provide. The pride in that is that a lot of, you know, our mob, last generation, they would never have ever expected to see an Aboriginal person from their own mob do a PhD in clinical psychology. And for them to actually just witness that, and the pride in that in one generation, that's why you never forget, and you always go back home and you do all those things that you should be doing, you know.
Yeah, it's huge. and what's your experience been, just from like where you grew up and then what you've seen, you know, because obviously you're based over in the western half of the country, and just when it comes to intergenerational trauma?
Yeah. Oh, look, it all comes, what we know, with our high rates of suicide. We have the highest rates of child suicide in the world in Western Australia. And, of course, where it affects us predominantly is the Kimberley of Dunmaheady, carried most of the burden of those suicides now for a couple of decades. And really the top half of Australia, sadly, is where most of the burden, top half of Northern Territory, top half of Queensland. Mm. Where it all leads to, Jake, always is with forcible removal. The origin is always the forcible removal. The science tells us that John Bowlby, who's considered to be the godfather of attachment theory, actually says if you lose a primary attachment, i.e. mum or dad, he says it's impossible to recover from that. Impossible. And so we've actually had generations of forcible removal. So that's the first bit. That's horrific. You remove a child from a family, you lose that ability to, your parents actually teach you about, you know, about yourself as being loved and lovable. The predictability of that love and care and affection is what actually teaches you as a kid to develop your own strength of attachment and then pass that on to your own children. If that's lost, then how do you actually learn, you know, how to attach to your own children? How do you actually learn how to respond to all the emotional needs your children have, because you didn't have that in your past? Now, the additional layer that we've experienced in Australia is the fact that it was denied for 208 years. And the first step to healing, the first step to healing is that your trauma is validated, that someone says what happened to you was wrong and it should never have happened. And the fact that it took 208 years to happen meant that we've had you know, generations of families who start to question their own trauma. And if you question whether you've actually experienced trauma, then the likelihood of you passing that trauma down without even realizing you're doing it is virtually guaranteed. Because a big part of what we do as psychologists is develop this thing called insight in people. You know, when you actually are aware of the fact that I'm actually acting like this because of my history or because of my past or because of my trauma. If you don't even understand that you've experienced trauma, then there's no potential there for someone to have insight around that. There's no potential for someone to put their hand up and say, I need treatment for my anger, I need treatment for whatever, because they don't understand the origin of it. And so what we've done, not surprising at all, is when people have trauma, it's very common that they repeat the patterns of their own trauma. And so I'm not surprised that we have these pockets of the Kimberley, the Northern Territory, Queensland, you know, parts like that, where you have a suicide in a family, and then you'll have generations of suicide that just gets, you know, just gets passed down, if you like, through families, through you know, communities. And that's what trauma actually looks like. That's what, you know, intergenerational trauma looks like.
Big time, yeah, you see, because, like, you know, with my grandfather, he came through the Stolen Generation through Kinchilla Boys Home in New South Wales, and a lot of my family did, and you can just see how, like, it, I'll personally see it, how it's trickled down, but also through a lot of other families and mob around the country where it's been affected. And that's what frustrates me when they go, oh, you know, just get over it, this happened years ago. It's like, no, this perpetuates. And what you were talking about, whether that's, you know, suicide and then certain other likes of trauma, and it just, and without people not even going through life, and where this stuff sits in the subconscious, and like what you're saying, whether it's anger or forms of self-harm or whatever it may be, that just comes out without not knowing it. And that's those forms of intergenerational trauma, eh?
Yeah, absolutely. And you are hardwired to react to the world in a certain way. And so, you know, often if you're around, for example, lots of other people who have experienced trauma, you pass that trauma back and forth. Mm. And so it's actually very common that, you know, you have a trauma as a kid, you're more likely to have a trauma as an adult. And there's an actual scientific name for it. It's called repetition compulsion. So, you know, for example, if you have anger that's normalized in your family home, for example, like anger becomes normalized, then, you know, you almost develop a sense of tolerance for it. And so you are hardwired to react to the world in a certain way without realizing that you are. And often what will happen is, say, for example, you look at someone who's, you know, who is that way, that has, you know, anger becomes normalized. They'll often say things to me like, sis, I didn't even realize all of a sudden I just went bang. And I didn't actually recognize the build up to it. Okay. So that's what the hardwiring component is. And so my job is to get people to be tuned in to the build-up. And so then we've got more of an opportunity to actually prevent the bang. You know, a bang might be anger, or bang might be a suicide attempt, or bang might be whatever. But the insight stuff is really around that. They're giving people that awareness and strategies to actually prevent it from getting to that point. And we haven't done that with mob at a level that it needs to be done, you know, based on the history.
And does it get tricky working with youngsters too, like, because that of, depending on the background they're going in, because, you know, you got to, there's a lot of, you know, when you're looking at the justice system in general, it doesn't matter what state or territory, when you got to, where they've made up of a lot of Aboriginal kids, but where, you know, early intervention is, you know, really important. And is it, when you're talking about inciting and some of these other works, when it's got to do with the psychology, is it, is what are your thoughts of you know, what's needed to be done when it's got to do with, you know, youngsters that are, if it's, they're just having trouble in their community, or they're going through justice as, you know, young adults or children in general? What's the thoughts there?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the early intervention side of things is that, I guess, you look at something like the Kimberley, where what we're finding is a lot of our suicides, and interestingly enough, a lot of our crimes are highly impulsive. And what that means is that people look as if they overreact to interpersonal conflict or whatever. Mm. And so what we've actually learned, I guess, is that we're getting there, and what we want to do is we want to teach young kids in particular this thing called distress tolerance skills, because what we find is that we have pockets right, of high risk, whether it's intergenerational families who make up the burden of the suicides or make up the burden of the crime rates or whatever. And so what we want to do is we want to identify those families and get in there and do early intervention for those kids that are more at risk of those sorts of things because they've been exposed to known risk factors. And so the big thing that we do is just get in there and teach them effective communication skills, anger management skills, distress tolerance skills, all those things that we know give us our best opportunity of preventing things from, you know, either the suicides, you know, being ingrained or criminality being ingrained or whatever. But what we're not actually doing is we're not actually identifying those high-risk regions and proactively getting in there and doing early intervention prevention. And that's what we should be doing more of, teaching them at that level before things become problematic. we want to develop the skills before the crisis occurs. And what often happens is you'll have all this youth crime and all of a sudden all the services are running around reacting to, whereas what we want to do is identify those high-risk cohorts and get in there and develop strategies in kids that we know give us our best opportunity of crime reduction, best opportunity of suicide reduction. And it's all those things I've already talked about, teaching kids how to manage interpersonal conflict, teaching kids distress tolerance skills, because this is what we know. Most of our crimes and most of our suicides are really impulsive. They're really quick. You know what I mean? They'll have a relationship breakdown, they'll have an argument, they'll have a blow-up, and then they'll just go bang. And then they'll do things at this level that means they're not able to access the higher-level thinking part of their brains. And that's what we know impulsive crimes and suicides actually look like, that people can't step outside of emotion and access that higher-level thinking part of their brain. Very, very common with people that have attachment loss and very common with people who have trauma. So
there you go. So what does it look like to you if it's getting in allied health components within the community, if it's multifaceted teams, different disciplines? Like what would that look like?
Yeah, look, it's different types of intervention. So for us, for example, we know that if you look at crime as an example, we know that there are around 80% of Aboriginal people will never come into contact with the justice system. So we need to be really clear about this, is that if we did this thing called geo-mapping of crimes, what we'd find is that you go into any region, for example, if I went into Port Hedland, it's a really good example, that's got a population of 20,000, pretty high Aboriginal population area, you'd actually find there's probably about 20 families that make up all of the crime data. And the reason why is because exposure to criminality, it tends to increase the chances, increase the odds that someone in the next generation will end up in prison, someone in the next generation will end up, you know, in child protection services, whatever. So it makes sense for us to proactively go into those high-risk families and do focused and targeted intervention in those families to prevent that process, you know, people coming into contact with the criminal justice system. And so that's what different types of intervention prevention actually look like, that you proactively go in there, identify those sorts of families who, you know, are at high risk for, you know, contact with the criminal justice system, and provide them with the coping strategies and tools and those sorts of things that we know prevent the odds of that occurring.
Yeah, great. And just want to jump into the Westerman Duryea Institute for Indigenous Mental Health, and just want to know, but what's involved here? And just with the reasons of really sort of starting this up and elevating it.
Yeah, I love telling this story because it started out of frustration, Jake. We had, but it's now become so optimistic and full of hope, really. It's been incredible. The highest rates of child suicide in the world in Western Australia and in the Kimberley, and how the government's responded to that is they've had four successive inquiries. So they had the 2009 Hope Inquiry, they had the 2016 parliamentary inquiry, I was an expert witness at that, the 2018 Senate inquiry and 2019 Fogliani inquiry. Now, you don't need to be an educated scientific person to know that inquiries give you nothing useful.
That's right, yeah.
You know, and look, the evidence speaks for itself. Suicides have continued to escalate as governments continue to have inquiries. And so I got really frustrated and went, okay, people are missing the point here. People are missing the point that our remote communities, our highest risk communities, they're missing the point that access to services is a massive issue for people. But many of those kids, every coroner's report concluded that all those children were dying from what's referred to as system failure. And system failure is a nice way of saying a lack of access to culturally appropriate services, right? So I picked up the phone that day and I started the did a media release, and I donated $50,000 of my own money to start the Dr. Tracy Western Indigenous Psychology Scholarship Program. Now, that means that $10,000 a year is a scholarship. So it was over, the idea is over 5 years. Now, very, very quickly, lots of other people went, of course we need Indigenous, more Indigenous psychologists. Who didn't think of this? Why didn't we think of this before? Of course that's what you need, you know.
Yeah.
And so in the first year, we got enough donations, just purely from people in the public, just donating money. And so then we became a charity really quickly.
Nice.
In the first year, we were able to allocate 15 Indigenous psychology scholarships across Australia.
Really?
Yeah, just in the first year. So we managed to raise.
Hold on, in the first year.
Well, we're kind of still in our first year, Jake, to be honest, because we launched it on World Suicide Prevention Day, which is September 10th. And that was an obvious thing because we went, okay, World Suicide Prevention Day, no one even mentions Aboriginal on World Suicide Prevention Day.
No.
And there's no greater injustice than to be invisible, than to feel your pain matters less. And that made me quite cranky. And I went, I'm so sick of my mob being invisible. We've got the highest rates of child suicide in the world, and it's not even mentioned. And so I do a lot of media on
and that's in the world, you know.
And in the Kimberley, you know, like in if you took the Kimberley out of the equation, the suicide rates, frankly, would probably fall pretty close to mainstream. So for me, you sit there and you go, what have government been doing? Like when you've got children should not be dying from want in a world of excess. We are a first world country, you know.
Yeah, and is there anything brought to the attention? Like, I know you got closing the gap, right? You got the different pillars and different sections of what they try and embark on there to close, and you're never going to fully close the gap, right?
Yeah.
But it's trying, you know, it's bettering it in a sense. But is there anything in regards there that are honed in when it's got to do with like the mental health and it's got to do with the suicide prevention and what can assist you, like you mob out west, but just Australia as a whole?
A couple of real simple things, Jay. They only actually put suicide in the closing the gap just last year. And so I guess that's the first thing. Like, we've got the highest rates of child suicide in the world, arguably amongst the highest rates of Indigenous suicide, you know, amongst the highest rates, and it's not even considered to be one of our targets. So they've only just put that in. The second thing that I will be doing with the Junior Institute is we need to, there are no programs are required to demonstrate that they're reducing suicide risk factors. So all this money that's been put into suicide prevention, there's not one program except for the ones that I deliver, that the Junior Institute are going to hopefully expand across Australia, that have actually shown that they're reducing suicide risk. So that's the second thing. You just need to say, okay, guys, you need to measure outcome. You need to make sure that your programs are actually measuring suicide risk reduction. And so that's the first thing. You can't close a gap if you're not measuring a gap. You know, so that's obviously a pretty critical thing. So this year with the Julia Institute, we've just got a Lottery West grant, and we'll be doing that. We'll be actually creating a national database and assisting people to be able to measure suicide prevention outcome with their funded programs. And it's quite complicated in its explanation, but that's essentially what we'll be doing to drive.
No, that's great.
Yeah.
Because that's going to not, you know, that's not going to only help mob as a whole, because research, like the important work of having First Nations psychologists and helping mobbing community, so important, but where you can back it up and have that research and data, because you know that's what the government and other entities run on when it's got to do with data, number and figures. But the thing is, that's just helping mob in general, and when it's going to come to, if it's more government grants, or that's going to help the charity as a whole. And if you've already got 15 psychologists straight off the bat, and you know where that's helping them develop, and you're And then all of a sudden, and what, and I'm glad you said that as well, when you're talking about you want to start pushing this across the nation, because you're already, you know, you're looking at running a strong program over West. And the thing is, and I think, and when I look at psychology in general, when I, what's funded, when I'm thinking about like fetal alcohol spectrum disorder and the other sorts, where it, all of that's heavily funded over in WA and some of the resources are there, compared to like you're looking at the population over here on the East Coast and you look at the people that really practice and can clinically diagnose fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, it's nearly night and day between East Coast and West Coast, even though the population is greater over there. But and even some of the research that I know of, and it always seems to come out of Fitzroy Crossings when I look at if it's FASD or other sorts, suicide and why is that, when it's always honed in on, from your point of view, from the research and data?
Look, I think some of it is basically because of the history, you know, that sadly the Kimberleys had, you know, the highest rates of suicide. So, of course, that's been a focus with people. But I will actually say, though, that even though I'm based in WA, I've spent probably most of my time, I spent about 10 years living in New South Wales, and I spent most of my time travelling. I trained about 40,000 practitioners across Australia, and that's every single part of Australia. So the great part of that is that they've all been accredited in my unique screening tools, all those which I developed quite a number of. And so the great part of the Julia Institute is that it's going to be really easy for us then to capture all that data that's been, you know, whether it's in Alice Springs, whether it's in Kempsey, whether it's in Cherbourg, whether it's in, you know, Sydney. There are so many people who I've trained that the great part of it is that they're all using these screening tools that enable us then to capture all that information to unlock answers to questions that we've never had answers to at a national level. So it's really exciting stuff, the Julia Institute, in terms of what we're going to be doing. I should actually say also that we've got 26 students now, so we've just announced another 11. We had a fundraising concert in Perth that is really exciting. World Suicide Prevention Day, we had John Butler headline.
Nice. Yep. Yeah.
Gina Williams, Bo Jessie Pigram, Naomi Pigram, Kobe Morrison. And so it was this big, massive concert that everyone worked pro bono for free. And we end up raising $140,000 in ticket sales. And just people just donating money. Hey, like, it's just been incredible. So we announced another 11. So now we've got 26 Indigenous psychology students that we're financially supporting, but I also personally mentor every single one of them.
That is great.
Yeah, it's really
26. Funny. And they're all situated in WA, yeah?
No, all over Australia. So
they're all over Australia, yeah, right.
So we've got a couple, one in Kempsey actually, one just outside of Casino, one that's based in Sydney, one that's based, we've got the first Indigenous Tasmanian psychology. She just graduated last year as well.
Wow.
She's going to continue on and do her masters. We've got, I think we've got about 9 in Western Australia, 7 in Queensland, 1 in Northern Territory, about 6 in South Australia. So yeah, it's all over Australia, which is pretty amazing. And about 8 Indigenous male psychology students. So that's really cool.
God, you're building an army of this mob, eh?
I'm building an army. That's why the hashtag. I just love the build an army hashtag because Like as an example, like at a real practical level, hey, like I'm, you know, I consider myself to be a reasonably skilled psychologist. And you look at something like the Kimberley, and I was talking to a colleague the other day, and I said, because of the issues in the Kimberley and how dire it is in terms of Kimberley, I just said to my friend, you know, a psychologist, I said, would you work out in the Kimberley? And he turned to me and said, absolutely not. You know, because it's overwhelming in terms of just being the only person, the only psychologist in a remote area with high needs. And within a year of the Julia Institute, we've got 5 Indigenous psychology students from the Kimberley. So they will all be ready to go back to the Kimberley within a few years. Now, when you have a situation like, you know, remoteness, the complexity of the culture, all that sort of stuff, but you've got, say, 20 Indigenous psychologists in that region, it becomes effortless in lots of ways because you've got a pack you've got an army of Indigenous psychologists that can actually help with all the circumstances that you're dealing with every single day. So
that's so powerful.
Yeah, it really is, yeah.
Especially when you're sending this young mob back to, you know, if they're training wherever it may be, and then they're going back home, because the thing is, like, you're going to have, like, and the way I approach, because, like, with my work through Culture Connects, like, and where that's through the disability front, but when I'm talking to a lot of mob, like, it's not like, you know, I'm Wanneroo or Kamilaroi, but I don't go to, you know, if it's Central Australia or, you know, it's talking to people like TI or whoever it may be, talking along the same breath. Like, you've got to take each nation differently because how people react and, and you know, it's whole different language sets and different cultural beliefs and, and just being able to have that power of having this mob training up and then going back to their respectful nations, that's huge.
It's massive. And in a sense also, Jake, you have what you have, and you've seen this in every community you've gone to, is that you have people who, like, because I'm from a remote area, when I'm in a remote community, I just come to life. You know, I just absolutely love it. If you haven't grown up in a remote area, you know, it's really challenging. It's not something that's comfortable for you. And local people never leave. Local people will never, ever, ever leave. They're passionate about their communities. They'll work and work and work until, you know, everything is addressed to their to the extent that they're capable of. And so why not train local people up? I mean, it just makes so much sense, you know, at many levels. And then the next bit, of course, is that I'm just getting a little bit tired of the Aboriginal person always being the support act. You know, like the Aboriginal education worker or the Aboriginal police liaison officer, or, you know, and that's not suggesting that all of our amazing First Nations people don't do amazing work. But what I was finding when I was living my training workshops all over Australia is you have...
It's sort of the tokenism of it in a way,
Yeah, well, it's more of the systemic racism that even when people... Even when people advertise jobs, they look at certain things, they've never in their brains have this idea that they have an Aboriginal psychologist. And when you point it out to them, it's almost like there's a rebel, oh, there's Aboriginal psychologists, yes. And so, do you know what I mean? Like, we actually more than capable of. And so the thing I love about my students is that I say to them all the time, I should be able to drop you in a room with any psychologist in this country and you can more than hold your own. And they go and bring it on. And they're all getting distinctions. They are incredible in their scientific craft. And they also have that cultural complexity on top of it. And so they are extraordinary. And 26 of them now, and they are, I want them to put me in the shade, and they are, you know, and I want them, I want to feel dumb around them. You know?
Come on now.
Here's the thing. There's this thing about that the scientist brain in me is really interesting. I always say to people that, people think that we're concerned about the things that we have already been proven as scientists. Yep. Actually, we're concerned more about the things that we don't, that haven't been proven, that we don't know. Mm. And so I'll put my research out there, and what I want these students to do is to prove me wrong. Mm. You know, is to say, because that's what science demands. Science demands
that's it.
Recruiting and getting better. And I have no problem at all with one of my students saying, hey, Trace, that was a really good paper. However, I actually think you were wrong here. That's music to my ears. that's where we're getting, you know.
Well, that's it. It's, you know, just finding, you know, if it's a new frontier of whatever it may be, and if it's, you know, looking through a different lens, and it's always good to, no matter, you know, like the level that you're at, it's continuous learning, you know. So, and if you can find that through your students or whatever it may be, but not just what your students are learning or what you're learning, are you seeing within general academia, are they starting to take note of more of what's going on throughout the nation and to do with Aboriginality?
Yeah, definitely. And I think you know, let's be really blunt here. Universities have dropped the ball. They have not. Mm-hmm. They've dropped the ball when it comes to ensuring that anyone in the helping profession is culturally competent. There's no minimum standard or minimum requirement. So we are doing a lot of work now with universities to be really clear about the prerequisite. They need to embed Indigenous curriculum within their psychology degrees, which they don't do. They'll teach you a mainstream training, and then they'll have a side order of Cultural Awareness 101, you know, which is, it's not good enough, you know. And so the Army of Psychologists, they're inheriting my research. And so essentially what they're then able to do is continue to contribute to an Indigenous-led evidence base. Whereas at the moment, what they're doing is they're doing their honours or masters or PhDs on a mainstream evidence base. And so they're not plugging up any gaps in our knowledge. And so that's, again, a great thing about the Gilyer Institute is that all of my data and research, all of my 26 students get pole position to actually do their research on furthering that and continuing to an evidence base that has been developed by Aboriginal people for Aboriginal people. And that's where we need to be. And then when that happens, we provide mainstream with irrefutable evidence of cultural difference. And then they can't deny its existence. Whereas at the moment, you can get dismissed quite a lot and say, well, there's no evidence to support that. Well, there's no evidence that this exists. So my culture-bound syndromes paper, Joe, that's a classic example. That now that paper's actually been published, they can't now dismiss that culture-bound phenomena exists. So that's a really important thing. And the next bit is that someone in New South Wales, one of my students in New South Wales can replicate it over there. One of my students in Queensland can replicate it over there. Yes, it's mostly West Australian-based, that paper. So that's what I'm talking about in terms of they can then replicate that in different parts of Australia, which is really exciting. Yeah.
That's it. It's like, you know, we're all First Nations Australians, but then it's like having the mob that are, you know, taking that from WA but divulging it and then utilising those tools to how it would work within their local communities, that's for sure.
Definitely. And look, you know, I've travelled a lot around Australia, so anecdotally I know, like I've been yarning with you.
Yeah.
And straight away when I said, you know, spiritual visit, you're nodding your head. And so I know that this stuff exists all over Australia, but you need to put it in a format that mainstream cannot deny, and that means in a scientific form. So, you know, how do you make culture scientific? Well, you test it and test it and test it until First Nations people agree that it exists, and then they can't argue with it, you know?
Yeah, true. And, hey, have you got Mr. Ken White or some of these other politicians taking note of this or what?
the thing I love about the Gilyer model is that it's grassroots. You know, like it's Aboriginal people going, we've got this, and it's people, we're not beholden to political support, we're not beholden to certain government support. We will get there, no doubt. In terms of monetary support, no.
Yeah. Because I'm just thinking, this is so important. I'm just thinking, are they sniffing around and seeing what you guys are doing and saying, hey, like, yous are doing good work. Well, you know, X, Y, and Z. Like, I'm just, yeah.
Yeah, not yet, but look, and they are. Look, they certainly pay attention to it. And the good thing about having a charity is that we'll employ some people soon. So we've got a general manager starting soon, a research manager just for our research grant. Up until this point, it's been it's myself and a couple of board members working on our own time. So we haven't had any staff in Gilyer. So once we get staff on board, we can start to then develop those, you know, research funding and grants and relationships a little bit better. But
well, it sounds like it's only going to snowball big time from here. Yeah. Like, it's good, solid work, and it's not. And like with what you're doing, and you got X amount of 26 mob that you got training up, and that's huge. And then you said 8 males, yeah. So, and then you know you got research behind it, and having those other facets that are just that's galvanizing what you're doing and the importance of it, which is huge.
The great thing is too, Jake, is that you look at philanthropy, right? Philanthropy Australia, where, you know, high net wealth individuals and what they donate to. And something like only 5% of very wealthy people in Australia donate to mental health and suicide prevention, 5%.
That's nothing.
And the reason why is because I can't see the outcomes. The Gilyer Institute, around about 85% of our money that's come in has been philanthropic, has been donations through our website, has been high net worth individuals, you know, donating, funding a scholarship recipient or whatever. Mm. And that's what I love about it, is that we have a diversity of base in terms of the people who that enables Gilyer to run. which is just perfect,
Yeah, I totally understand that. And when you're looking at the 5%, because I'm also thinking from when you're looking at the disability front and you're looking at invisible disabilities, when it's the stuff you can't see physically. So then that's harder to gauge when you're going to put money up against that, you know, and that's whether it's got to do, you know, in some sort of facets to do with the National Disability Insurance Scheme and, you know, and if it's not having, oh, it's just ongoing and I can really feel that frustration too. But, and like a major frustration of mine is like when you're looking at over representation of mob in general when it's got to do with incarceration. So what's your thoughts of when it's looking at different lights of what should be done instead of just throwing mob in jail when you're looking at, you know, cultural rehabilitation facilities or other sorts of different accommodation outlets? What do you think's more appropriate than just throwing mob in jail and just letting them rot? What's your thoughts?
Look, the first thing again, we don't have, we need to get people before they end up in jail. That's the obvious thing. And we have a prison love affair in this country. We love locking people up. And in fact, we are the highest incarcerator of black people in the world, in Western Australia and in Australia. To put it in perspective, 6 times the rate of black incarceration as during South African apartheid. And it's interesting when people say things like, well, you can't look to America and, you know, you can't compare Australian issues to America. It's much worse over here. We have 2.6 times the rate of incarceration of Aboriginal people compared to African-American populations. So we have a George Floyd moment every month, right? So I guess the first thing is that what we're doing in the Julia Institute is we're looking at developing our own unique assessment tools, which will enable us to identify early risk factors for criminality. That's the perspective of what to do with people who may be at high risk, like the youth and all those sorts of things. Mm. Do early intervention, coping strategies, all those sorts of things I've talked a little bit about. But the big thing that's really missing, it's like the elephant that no one wants to talk about for some reason, is racism. And the contribution of racism to the over-incarceration of black people in this country. And we've done a bit of work around developing cultural competency in police. I did a pretty big project in South Australia. And what we're able to do is we've got a couple of tools that measure cultural competency, and they're the first ones globally that have been developed. What that enables us to do is we've been able to figure out what predicts cultural competency. And then what we do is we target the skills that we know increase the likelihood of people being culturally competent. What that actually gives us a possibility of doing in this country, which is actually a global first, is looking at whether increasing the cultural competency of police results in lower rates of incarceration. And so, you know, that national database I've talked about, that's driving as a national database, is looking at. So you look at something really practical. In South Australia, their highest risk region would be Port Augusta, right?
Yeah, Port Augusta, yep.
And you know that. And any state, you can name a certain region that is your highest risk, you know.
Oh, 100%.
You know what I mean? And so, you know, whether it's Palm Island in Queensland or whether it's Townsville, you know, there are high risk regions. So what we actually do then is go into those high risk regions and develop, you know, test cultural competencies, target the areas of need, evaluate those outcomes in terms of improved cultural competency, and track it against local crime data. So then what we're able to demonstrate at a scientific level is, do improvements in cultural competency of police result in lower rates of crime, lower rates of police, you know, over-policing, essentially. And then what happens is that local data will feed into the state data, feed into the national data. So then it becomes more solvable. If we improve the cultural competency of police, watch the crime rate fall. You know,
it's so important.
Yeah. So it's statistical, but it's also really clear about the sorts of things that are making an impact on the crime rates. Whereas at the moment, we don't know any of that. You know, we don't do any of that.
No, and that's only going to help, you know, the justice system as a whole and, you know, when it's got to do with mainstream Australia, because you've got so much subconscious bias, like with a lot of, it doesn't matter what the profession, like, and I've felt it too, even when,
Everywhere,
yeah. Yeah, you know, when you're walking through the door and you're already being judged without them, you know, and that's already sitting, they're not even thinking it, and it's already, you know, the judgment's already there. So
you can smell racism a long way, can't you? That's what I say. You know, it's a look, it's all that sort of stuff that you know, with disability as well. You see the look, you see the body language, you see the non-verbal cues, you know, it's you can see them a long way, you know.
Yeah, because it'd be good, like with what you're building there, like, you know, if it's got to do with, because I'm just thinking when it's got to do with disability, also when you got to do if it's, you know, intellectual, cognitive, psychosocial, and when you're looking at mob, just because in New South Wales, and this is New South Wales Justice, their numbers, right? Like a lot of, and this is just to do, yeah, so with the kids. So you got 73% of the First Nations kids that are coming in incarceration in New South Wales have got some sort of form of disability.
Yeah,
That's huge,
it
you
is.
know.
It is.
Yeah. And then when you're looking at indefinite detention and people not, you know, unfit to plead, and like you're looking at over your way, WA, and when you're looking at Marlon Noble, you know, spent 10 years in a Western Australian prison and, you know, not being even convicted of a crime, you know,
Most,
which.
you know, vast majority of Aboriginal people wouldn't even meet the benchmark for fitness to plead up in the Pilbara, you know. And most the rates of incarceration, you know, in my region, and you see everywhere, the are just absolutely astronomical. The other thing, Jake, I just want to get back to in terms of the crime stuff is a big thing that comes out from people, Aboriginal people who end up in custody. So we want to prevent them from getting there, but when they get there, there are no Indigenous specific programs. So they're all from the UK or from Ireland or from whatever. And so what will happen with an Aboriginal person ends up in prison for whatever reason, they will go, okay, I want to actually now improve myself. I want to get some treatment that will actually address the factors that resulted in me getting here in the first place. And a big thing, obviously, is identity. Like most of the suicides I respond to, frankly, have some sort of identity issue implicated in them. So people struggling with their identity, okay? Whether it's you know, because of racism, lateral violence, whatever. So racism is a very, very, very big predictor of lots of things. 30% of depression is accounted for by racism alone, right? So then you get into a prison environment and you get these mainstream programs and they don't actually deal with things like racism. They don't deal with things like identity. They don't deal with
No.
things like all the cultural stuff that we've talked a lot about. And so what happens is they're not actually addressing the Indigenous specific factors that led to, you know, mob being in prison in the first place. And so that's a massive issue. And again, a big part of what we're doing at the Julia Institute is figuring out the sorts of unique risk factors that Aboriginal people have and designing programs around those unique Indigenous risk factors, you know, like identity, like cultural resilience. What separates an Aboriginal person who ends up in prison from the Aboriginal person who doesn't end up in prison? You know, often this person has more robustness, cultural resilience than the other person. So our programs will also look at developing up robustness, protective factors, those sorts of things. But it has to be Indigenous specific. That's the thing that people don't
Yeah,
understand, you know.
big time. And is that programs that say certain justice organizations, like whatever the state may be, that be able to have a hold of, but
Yeah,
if
definitely.
it's also something that can be implemented to have where they can run programs within their prisons that can help
Definitely.
Indigenous people, yeah.
Definitely. The idea behind the Julia Institute is that we'll become essentially like, you know, the training institute. So people can, if they're going, look, because I get this a lot, I get people saying, oh, sis, we've got money for suicide prevention.
Yep.
How do we evaluate that? And so we'll be able to help them do that. Here you go. Here's a tool. Here's some content. Here's how you do it. We can mentor people around that sort of stuff. So absolutely, they should be deferring to a centre of excellence, if you like, that's run by
Yep.
Indigenous people for Indigenous people, rather than going into a mainstream service that, you know, is going to teach them mainstream stuff.
So, and you're sort of thinking of a lot, like instead of going into prisons also, there might be in the future where this may help build up, like you might have a prison, but maybe a part of it might be more culturally appropriate, or I'm just thinking along when it's got to do with cultural rehabilitation. So
there's got to be all those things, Joe. There's got to be early intervention. There's no investment in that. Something like 80% of the corrective services budget. I look at Western Australia as an example. They have a $1 billion corrective services budget. $900 million is spent on locking people up, essentially. And what's that saying? You know, if you build it, they will come. Let's build more prisons. And, of course, if you're not providing people early intervention and prevention activities, and by the way, it costs a lot of money to lock people up.
It does.
$500,000 a year to lock an Aboriginal kid up.
Mm-hmm.
So prevention, early intervention, and justice reinvestment costs significantly less. But for some reason, we are a country that just loves locking people up, whether it's black people or white people, more so black people, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But we have this prison love affair in this country and an early intervention allergy, really, and a prevention allergy. You know, like, it's insane.
100%. And if you're looking at some of these private prisons, like, where, you know, they're going to be wanting just to bring these people in, like, because you got one, like, some just up the road from us on the Central Coast, like new ones that have popped up at Grafton and some of these other ones, and they're just accumulating people, you know. And
well, the thing that's really interesting, hey, so the strongest predictor of criminality is the early normalisation of criminality through an early prison sentence, right? Mm-hmm. So the minute you actually normalise criminality in someone's environment, it increases the odds that that will be their pathway. I look at something like a Grafton, I look at something like a remote community called Roban that I've already mentioned. That has a population of 700.
Did you say Roma?
Roban.
Roban, yeah.
Roban. So Roban's in Queensland. Roban, 700 population, pretty much 100% Aboriginal. Roban has its own maximum security prison. Now, come on now, you know, it creates the environment, you know.
That's right. They'll pinpoint that geography. Look at 100% Aboriginal population. Let's throw that in there and just lock up the whole population within that Roban and the surrounds.
You know? Yeah, particularly with kids. I mean, we know that, you know, the strongest predictor is an early prison sentence. So the minute you put a kid in prison at, say, 10 or 11 or whatever, you've taken away their possibilities before they have any possibilities. And so that then becomes like normalized very, very early in study. And often people will say things like, oh, just cut out some time. It's no drama, it's a slap on the wrist. These are prisons. They're not detention centres. They're not holiday camps. They're prisons. And so the minute you normalise that for a kid, that then creates a perfect storm of a kid actually not feeling as if they've got any other option other than to go to prison at 10 years of age.
That's it. It normalises.
Yeah.
You know, because I've talked to so many mob where they feel comfortable being inside, or where I talk to mob and they say it's the people that are working within these facilities. It's like they want you to feel welcome. They want you to feel like this is normal, you know?
They're using prisons as hostels, and, you know, when the prison's there, from the perspective of a magistrate, the heavy lifting is to do the early intervention prevention work. So if a kid has, say, for example, a kid feels unsafe in their home, often what that means is that the parents haven't learned how to parent. So the parents have their own compromised attachment. The heavy lifting is to deal with that, the compromised attachment, that from their own trauma and all the rest of it. Untreated childhood trauma is the strongest predictor of people ending up in prison. And so if you're not dealing with the untreated childhood trauma, it strongly predicts violence, it strongly predicts incarceration rates, it strongly predicts child removal. So the heavy lifting is to do that. The easy lifting is to just send a kid to prison, you know, because the prison's right there. And so what's going to end up happening in Australia is that prisons cost so much to run, Jake, that we're going to actually end up running out of money. And maybe we'll have to get to that, that it becomes an economic argument that, you know, what we
know. It already is. Like, it's insane.
Yeah. We can say early intervention costs a hell of a lot less than locking someone up, you know.
Yeah, 100%. So, and in between that early intervention, or when it's got to do between, you know, the community and the actual jail itself, incarceration units, when you're looking at the justice system, when you're talking about, you know, when you got the judges and the barristers and the lawyers. So what, Like, do you think there should be more cultural based, like if it's got to do with actual cultural court systems, like there already is, like you got Crow Court in New South Wales and Murray Court in Queensland, but do you think, and where that was adopted, you had, because you, what I noticed and what I've seen over the years where we've adopted a lot from First Nations Canadians, like Canadian Aboriginals and their system. So do you think, you know, there should be more, you know, cultural, what components do you think should be when it's got to do in that justice system before they reach an incarceration unit?
And this is where we need to drive this ourselves as Indigenous psychologists, right? So, yeah, look, it's great stuff that's happened and worked in Canada. That's great. But our situation is very peculiar in Australia. So example would be, I was in Newman not long ago, and you have one person there who's a Māori interpreter. That's for the dominant language up there. So he's a Māori interpreter. Mm. You have an Aboriginal person charged with a crime. The Aboriginal person has English as a third language. Then there's the issue of around, the copper said I did it, so maybe I did do it. So there's this thing called other race effect that's actually really interesting, and that means that any Aboriginal will do. Now, in the US, what they've actually found is the other race effect that any black person will do has actually resulted in something like 50% of crimes being overturned based on DNA evidence.
Wow.
That's
insane.
It's insane. So you hear that on the ground, you hear people saying, well, the copper said I did it, so I must have done it, right? So take all that out of the equation. What actually happens is the district magistrate comes every month to Karratha. Now, Karratha's 400 kilometres away from Newman. So what actually happens is the fellow from Newman has to get himself to Karratha to have his case heard in front of the magistrate that's come from Perth. The one Māori interpreter for the whole of the Pilbara gets rung up and says, you better get to Karratha because you have to interpret what the magistrate's saying to the Aboriginal guy who's been charged with this offence. So essentially the Māori interpreter is acting as if he's the lawyer. Now, this is justice Aboriginal style in a first world country. So that what we need to do is we need to get in there and figure out fitness to plead. We need to get in there and actually we've developed tools around this to actually determine people's understanding of a police, you know, of a judicial process, all those sorts of things. And they're psychometric tools, basically.
So that's great, because I was going to ask that. So
So that's the first bit, is that, you know, people don't understand the legal process. That's fundamental. That's a fundamental thing. But the reason why people don't want to make a call on it is that the minute you take culture into account in a court system, it opens up the floodgates for every Aboriginal person. It's too high risk.
That's right, yeah. Because I think that's going to blanket the nation, and they're going to be like, whoa, let's put the handbrake on here.
Exactly. So when you actually don't even understand when English is your second and third language, you can't instruct a lawyer, you can't do all those sorts of fundamental things that, you know, we should be able to do when we're actually in front of a magistrate or a judge, then that's something that really needs to be sorted. And what Canada did years ago is they bought this thing in called Gladue. And Gladue it's in legislation, and that came into legislation, I think, in 1989. And what that meant was that if there's an Aboriginal offender or an Aboriginal victim, the magistrate or judge is required to have this thing called a Gladue report. And a Gladue report goes into all the background cultural aspects of why they've ended up where they've ended up.
And that's great.
It's fantastic, yeah. And because it's in legislation, that then means that the government have a legal responsibility to make sure there's enough people to do Gladue reports. And so that's what we're finding in Australia, is that the magistrate does not have the cultural context, or the judge doesn't have the cultural context, and so often what they're doing is they're doing whatever they can with what's in front of them, and assessment hasn't occurred in the most culturally appropriate way, so the magistrate or judge can't base their sentencing or rehabilitation on the sorts of things that led to the person being in front of them in the first place, in terms of treatment and all that sort of stuff. So all roads lead to assessment, I always say. Get assessment wrong, get assessment right, you clean up all this stuff that we've been talking about, you know, really.
That's right, 100%. Yeah. And going back to a lot of those tools that you've touched on and having the right assessments in place before you know, bringing down the gavel and just, you know, sending mob off to prison, because it's just insane, like the numbers that are out there. But so if you had a magic wand, right, and if you're looking at, if it's got to do, because you've got, you know, urban, rural and remote. So if it's looking at services that can be implemented in community, when it's got to do with, you know, if it's psychology, touching on, you know, if it's helping people in and around justice or disability or whatever it may be, because people are always talking about services and having lack of. But what would it look like to you if you could put that magic wand around it and build up community?
I guess that's why I started the Junior Institute, I guess. And look, a magic wand would be any First Nations person in distress could go into a service and get best practice. That's the litmus test. It shouldn't be, oh, hang on a sec, I better ring the Aboriginal Medical Service because as a white collar, I don't know what I'm doing. You know, because then you've lost the opportunity for an Aboriginal person who has taken that difficult step of saying I'm in distress. And given that we only have 6% of Aboriginal people in distress who actually access services, that needs to increase, that needs to get to 100%. You know, that shouldn't be a circumstance that people are in distress and don't feel safe enough to go into the services that are available to be the best version of themselves they can be. And so it's everyone's responsibility. Yes, we've got the Army of Indigenous Psychologists, but what we also need is for white fellas to join us as well, non-Indigenous people to feel as affected by this, that there's a responsibility there. When you come from a position of privilege, there is a greater responsibility for you to do more of the heavy lifting, because First Nations people have been intolerably burdened for too long. We are 3% of the population. We cannot continue to have to address the highest rates of Indigenous suicide in the world, the highest rates of incarceration in the world. We need non-Indigenous Australians to join us equally in being as affronted by these statistics, because ultimately we are all Australians. We're all Australians, aren't we? You know, that's
right.
Comes down to at a basic level. Yeah.
100%. Doesn't matter if you're black, white or brindle, it's, you know, jumping on and help and build this army, you know, like you say, hashtag that. So, and that's, and then getting to, because mob for so long, you know, been getting sick of seeing, you know, it's been the merry-go-round of different services coming into community, and it's like, oh, you know, this ain't going to work. They've tried this, tried this. But if it's on a united front and having strong, you know, multifaceted disciplinary teams come in, whether, you know, being First Nations and then having, you know, whitefellas and other people coming on board and, you know, really cementing their places within, you know, the urban, rural and remote environments, because it's so important. We've got a long way to go, but.
Yeah, we're getting there, though. We're getting there, though, and I am so convinced of this Julia model, and a lot of it also is, here's the thing, as First Nations people, like we've had, for some of us, this is our first generation of workforce participation. You know, I was very lucky. My mum's dad worked as a taxi driver in Port Hedland. And how lucky was that, that I'm now in, you know, third generation of workforce participation. That's really unusual, you know. And so we're playing generational catch up here. You know, we really are. And so I think this generation is now challenging the world at a level we've never seen before. You know, they're now going, we're psychologists, we're lawyers, we're doctors, we're psychiatrists, we're whatever.
Mm.
Bring it on. And all we want is for non-Aboriginal Australians to join us and support us in that journey. We're prepared to do the heavy lifting here.
100%. And
that's what progress is, isn't it? Progress is that you close the gap in a generation, you know?
Yeah. No, touched on it solid. So, Dr. Westerman, so, you know, really appreciate your time. But is there anything that you wanted to cover in regards that you're doing at the Institute, or some of the research and data, or anything else that you're covering there? Because it's really important work. I want to make sure that you get this out and broadcast it to the atmosphere. So,
yeah, definitely. And I think probably the easiest way to go is to just say to people that, you know, just get on to our website, I guess, which is Julia is spelled J-I-L-Y-A, and Julia means my child in my Nyamal language. And people get that straight away, because this is about our children, and this is about our children having a future free of the highest rates of incarceration, the highest rates of suicide. We shouldn't continue to pass that burden on to our children. And so the best thing to do would just be to get on to just literally Google Julia and the Gender Institute will come up, and you can just contact us. And if you're an organisation that's remote or just wants to, you know, join us in this partnership to, you know, to drive best practice across this country, then just get in touch with us and drop us an email and you can be part of it. And if you want to even sponsor a scholarship, that's $10,000 a year for a scholarship. And that's change on the back of the couch for some people, you know. and then you can feel as if you're contributing to, you know, putting an Aboriginal psychologist into a remote community. If you're an organisation and you think you can either place a student, you know, for placements or employ a student upon graduation, mm-hmm. so many opportunities, Jake, that just get in touch with us. And, you know, it's really exciting what we're doing, you know, so it's great.
100%. That's awesome. So you mob out there, you heard hashtag build an army, you know, so many opportunities to jump on board and, you know, help the important work that's going on here, whether you want to get into psychology or just helping the Institute as a whole and the important work around Indigenous mental health and everything that surrounds that. So Dr. Westerman, again, really appreciate your time.
No worries. And just to start finish too, we are a registered charity, so every dollar is tax deductible. So another great thing is that you can just go on Julia's site and donate $5. You can donate $1. You can donate, you know, so that's the great thing about this whole story, Jake, is that people sometimes go, oh, I need to be really wealthy, and you know, no, you can donate $2. And we have had people donate $5, and it's just really cool.
Oh, know? Really?
Yeah. Like we've had and I love those donations. We've got I've got to tell this story because it's so awesome, but we've got...
Yeah, get it out there.
We've got a pensioner who, and it just brings tears to my eyes, these stories just bring tears to my eyes, but a pensioner who donates $10 a fortnight, $10 a week, and it comes in every week. And eventually I went, this is really interesting. I'm going to, you know, personally email, because I do that when I see these regular ones, and I emailed them. She just was overwhelmed, and she said, my daughter has married an Aboriginal man. I'm a pensioner and I didn't feel as if I wanted my grandchildren to have a better future, and I can't afford very much, but I can afford to at least do this, and I know that this is the best opportunity to make a difference to my grandchildren's future. And she donates $10 a week every single week, and it's just extraordinary, honestly, that.
Wow. Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah.
You know, doesn't matter if it's the person that you're talking about just now, or you know, if you are some high flying philanthropist, you know, so it comes people that want to donate and help.
Yeah,
that, it comes in many ways, shape, and form. So,
I
really appreciate you sharing that story, but also importantly, the work that you're doing within the community over in WA, but just where that's spreading as a whole. And I really, you know, hope it. You know, we start really building some of these psychologists up, and hopefully some of the other allied health components really take note of this and where they can jump on board as well.
Yeah, definitely. And look, we also need to be conscious of the fact we're only 12 months old. And look, I know we've inherited, Julia's inherited like 2 decades of research and data, but we only launched 12 months ago. And once we employ a full-time person, which is very soon, and a couple of full-time honestly, I don't want to wish my life away, Jake, but I reckon, you know, if we maybe check in 12 months' time, I reckon the Julia Institute is going to be doing some pretty awesome things across this country, just you know, to predict that.
Just quietly. No.
Just quietly, just between me and you, you know.
Awesome. Well, really appreciate your time for jumping on the podcast, spreading that out, the love and the important work, and 12 months on, we'll touch on base again and many other institutes going.
You can hold me to it now.
Awesome.
Awesome. Thank you, Jay. You have a lovely day. All the best. You too.
Talk soon. Bye. See, folks, after that yarn, you can see why we need more First Nations, Indigenous psychologists around the country in and around Indigenous mental health. Much needed. Doesn't matter if it's urban, rural, or remote. Need to get this mob out there. And you can help with the scholarship programs. As she said, she's building an army. And you can contribute by throwing some dollars in there. Solid work. And if you like the podcast, hit that subscribe button. Be much appreciated. And we've also got a Patreon page. So if you want to help further the channel, the podcast, the link is within the description. Check it out. And there's a tiered system in there. So if you choose one of them and you contribute, that'd be great. And if you want to get in contact with me, you can get me via Instagram at straightrollingcheater or email one word, straightrollingcheater@gmail.com. And we've also got a Facebook page. Keep Rolling with Jake Briggs, so check it out. I want to thank our sponsors, Permobil Australia, the greatest electric wheelchairs in the land. Wouldn't be sitting in anything else but these four wheels right here, and they got great assistive tech also. So righto, we'll see you on the next one.